Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the South Bay Show, South Bay Spotlight, on May 10th, 2018. Live, love, laugh, and leave a legacy. That's what we do here in the South Bay of Los Angeles on this magical mystery tour, and it's a beautiful place to do just
The South Bay Show is brought to you by the Academy of Foreign Languages. If you have any interest in learning a new language or brushing up on existing language skills, you should know about the Academy of Foreign Languages. Located in Palos Verdes, the Academy of Foreign Languages specializes in the art of communication. Their mission is to provide the finest language instruction possible. They recognize that each student has distinctive needs and craft their teaching technique to optimize an individual's particular learning skills. At the Academy of Foreign Languages, they strive to create a comfortable environment conducive to learning. So whether you're learning a new language or would simply like to converse in your native tongue, the Academy of Foreign Languages can accommodate you. For additional information, visit their website at academyofforeignlanguages.com, that's all spelled out, or call 310-975-4133.
I'm your host, Joe Terry, and you can read all about our many adventures on Facebook at facebook.com/The South Bay Show. Persistence, passion, principle, and purpose. That's what we talk about here on the South Bay Show. And of course, I'm not alone because of our great partnership with South Bay by Jackie.com and executive producer of the South Bay Show, Jackie Balestra. Hey, Jackie, how are you doing today on this magical mystery tour?
On this magical kind of day, I am doing fabulous. You know, it's Mother's Day. It's Mother's Day weekend coming up. And my birthday always falls on or around Mother's Day. I was actually born on Mother's Day. So I always get excited around Mother's Day because it's the birthday weekend. And we have a little thing. John made some plans for us this weekend, so I'm really looking forward to it. Did you have you made your plans for Carrie?
Yes, I think we have. We have made our plans. You know, I think we're going to do a bike tour, believe it or not.
Nice.
On electric bikes.
Oh, fun. Oh, fun.
Yeah, and we're probably going to, with our son, maybe our daughter, but certainly our son, we're going to take some electric bikes and drive up the coast, you know, up the Strand to maybe, you know, somewhere in Marina Del Rey.
Nice. Well, okay, talk about a segue. You're going to have to, since you're on the electric bike, you can actually do this. When you're on the street, take a ride up Grand Avenue in El Segundo, and you can see the new mural.
Oh, my gosh,
like
Jackie.
That?
What a great suggestion. What mural are you talking about, Jackie?
Well, we're going to get to that in a moment.
There's this old rust bucket water tank on Grand Avenue. I mean, it's what an eyesore. What are you talking about?
Well, it's not a rust bucket anymore. So I don't even want to waste any more time talking about it. We got to get to the show.
Jackie, who's our guest today?
Our guest this morning is legendary artist John Van Hammersveld. Now, John is an American graphic artist and illustrator who has designed album artwork for pop and psychedelic bands since the 1960s, including the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and the Grateful Dead. Born and raised in the South Bay, John has been an important figure in the local surf culture, which has influenced his art, such as the iconic poster for the surf film The Endless Summer. Now, John recently unveiled a massive mural on a tank at the DWP facility in El Segundo. And it was interesting, Joe, during the event, the DWP representative was so enthusiastic. He talked about John doing similar projects at their facilities up and down the California coastline. So welcome to the program, John. It's an honor and a privilege to have you join us this morning. And I won't even try to explain how excited we are.
Well, great. Great. Fantastic.
Yeah, isn't that tank something? I mean, really, I'm going to be in a helicopter next week taking pictures of it from up above, floating over the top of it.
You know,
which is almost the same as taking off at LAX and looking to the left and seeing the tank sitting there in El Segundo.
Yeah.
I saw an article.
Like this...
Go ahead, Joe. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask. Hello?
Where does something like this start, John?
Oh, okay.
Okay. All right. What's the question?
Where did something like this start? Did you come up
with the idea?
Start?
It's always connections, which is so strange. You know, is that I was at a Dewey Weber opening of a sculptor in front of a sculpture of him surfing in front of the Hermosa Auditorium there that we used to go to surf movies, and there was a fellow there, Wayne Cousins, who comes up to me and he says, you went to El Segundo High School, didn't you? And I said, yes. He says, well, you should be inducted into the High School Hall of Fame. So probably about 4 months later, then the mayor shows up, and Suzanne, and she's sitting at the table asking me if I want to be inducted into the El Segundo Hall of Fame. And so I agree and everything. And then by September of last year, then I'm in front of this auditorium of people, you know, and telling a story of one of my 18-year-old escapades going skiing to be a downhill racer, and how I fell and almost broke my nose or put my eye out, and decided I'd go to art school. So everyone laughs, and there's a couple people in the back that say, Hammer, which is my surf culture name when I was, in my teens. So we walk down the hall into this room, and there's a bunch of pictures, and I sit down at a table, and I'm about to eat my lunch, and Suzanne comes up to me and whispers in my ear, so would you do a mural for us? And so I sent her, two people down to my wife and agent, and they she said, yes, so we'll work on trying to put that together. And so so from September to January, everyone was negotiating and talking about it. And then in January, we met in front of the actual tank and with the DWP, you know, probably about nine people, and they said, well, you can't paint this because of the environmental condition of the paint and everything, and so then my two in my Spin, which is the company I use to manufacture all this stuff, they meet with the engineer, and we come up with a solution, and then we take a couple meetings, and it's around May something, and Suzanne says, well, I'm sort of like at the end of my mayorship here. I want this thing up, you know, so we had like 3 weeks to get it done. So a week for me to finish the art part of it, which I had been working on for like 6 months. And then the Spin had it for like a week to get it into its technical digital kind of assignment. And then it went to the manufacturer, and they were printing these 10-foot by 32-foot sheets of mesh print with my work printed on it. And then, then we were out at the tank there, the big brown, terrible-looking thing, and they had engineered a way to connect the sheets. There were like 52 sheets that 10 by 32 that had to be laced together to, go in the circumference of this image of a circular tube. And it was 510 feet long and 32 feet high. Massive, So if you looked at it in profile, it's 255 feet wide. as it sits there, and you see it from the, you know, from the beach road at the bottom there, you look up as you're driving up Grand, you see this massive, colorful band going across this, the sculpture.
It's got to be the talk of the town. It is something, public art, John, is something that is widely practiced and recognized in Europe very much. I mean, it's obviously practiced here in the U.S., but to this scale, it's something new and different, and everyone's talking about it and appreciating it. What was
Isn't that wonderful?
This the largest? Is this the largest canvas you've ever had?
Well, I had a for the 84 Olympics. I did a 360-foot by 12-foot six panels that wrapped halfway around the Colosseum at that time. This is much bigger than that, but it's close. So,
okay,
close to the Olympic size.
Jackie, did you have a comment or question?
Yes, I did. I was reading an article in one of the local papers, and they were talking about would it be possible to get some spotlights on it so that when people are flying in and out of LAX, they can see it at night. And I mean, it would be quite a sight. John, any chance that might happen?
Well, you know, when we were first there, you know, in January, they didn't have the electrical system to charge cars. And so they've just put that in over the last 3 weeks. So they have the possibility of continuing to electrify the place and put some lights up.
Yeah. No, that would be amazing. I mean, it would be amazing to see it from the air. But if you're driving along Vista Del Mar or up Grand, I mean, you'd be able to see it from there too. You'd be able, if you're taking a strand cruise or a walk on the beach, you'll be able to see it at night. That would be amazing.
Yeah,
it'd
be wonderful.
It really is something. I was there for the unveiling. Joe wasn't there, and we got to walk around. Joe, we got to walk around the entire tank, and John, you know, told us all about it as we were walking around it. And you told a story about going to school in El Segundo. It was interesting because you grew up in Palos Verdes, but you went to high school in El Segundo. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, how awkward could it be? There was like 45 minutes up and 45 minutes back, you know, round trip, an hour and a half a day just to go to school.
Yeah.
The nice part of it is that with my dyslexia, the dean of the school decided that I would have two art classes a day. So the 2 hours I had per day was building a whole new personality for me. While I was being a surfer on the weekends, my 5 days a week I was being an artist. So I became the surfer artist of the day. And created out of connections, putting the education of being a artist with being a surfer, the legend of creating the Endless Summer poster. I mean, it was amazing how that worked, you know. So I was in a new industry for about 3 years as a student and artist working in the surf industry, their virgin surf industry, the first of it. In Dana Point, you know, so group of industries, Hobie and John Severson of Surfer Magazine, Hobie Surfboards, Grubby Clark with the foam blanks, and Bruce Brown with the movie The Endless Summer. I was right in the middle of the new evolution of surf culture.
Right. So that iconic photograph, that was the beginning of this journey. I mean, was that your first big gig, that poster for the movie?
Yes, right, yes. No, I mean, the first gig was actually, you know, being 20 years old and hired by John Severson, who was like 27, to do his publication, and while going to school at the same time, you know, it was quite an opportunity. That launched an icon, The Endless Summer.
But
I went in town and went to art school and then ended up in the arts and entertainment business in Hollywood. And then you have the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and that whole new culture. So within you know, I guess it was probably 12 years, I evolved through the 60s and set into the 70s and had this incredible campaign in this kind of well distributed products of posters and album covers.
It's coming. It's like it's full circle because on the mural there's some text on it, and the mural itself is actually dedicated to Jacobs and Velzy.
Velzy and Jacobs.
Velzy
lived on a little street just very close to the tank, actually, in 1955, something like that, when I was about to pick up my first surfboard, you know, which then became the adventure of all time, you know, going on surf trips on the weekend up and down the California coast. I mean, this isn't New York. This is like L.A. and Santa Barbara and San Diego, and there must have been at least 14 to 15 different breaks, and at the end of the street where the break was, there was like a cult of kids, you know, that were all around the same age with our brand new, you know, balsa or foam boards. You know, it was an incredible culture that California had, you know, and then it became an industry. Huge industry that affected the whole world by the 80s.
People
flying in from Paris to get a pair of surf shorts because it was, you know, it was made in Orange County by Gotcha or Quicksilver. We used to in the 50s we would have our mother sew up a pair of trunks with some you know, material like kind of a heavy duct weave.
And it wasn't that long ago. It wasn't that. I mean, that's what's amazing. It wasn't that long ago.
Within the five decades. Yeah, I mean, it grew into this amazing industry. Yeah. So you know, it's a world. It's a worldwide. Very much like the Endless Summer was kind of pointed the direction that there was surf around the world, and then that became a culture.
And Joe, remember we both read that book Outliers about how a lot of it is being in the right place at the right time with the right group of people. You know, we saw it, you know, a couple of decades ago in Silicon Valley, and how all those guys came up together and created a whole new industry and culture. And this was the same thing, only 60 years ago.
Well, yeah. Now, being in Hollywood and being 23 to probably 32, everybody was the same age. You know, I would meet Mick Jagger. He was like a couple years younger. I would meet Clapton in London. You know, he was like 2 or 3 years younger. You know, everybody was like on the same generation and the same outlook of the world, you know, so that's the way it went.
Right.
When I was in, when I was down south in Dana Point, you know, in this sort of new revolution, again, I was like just the right age, and everyone was the same age as we moved through the industry. There were older guys who owned the actual companies that were probably 4 or 5 years older. But essentially, it's always like a generation that starts these movements. Then there's another generation that takes over and continues it to the next decade.
It's just those 4 or 5 years difference. Bill Gates and Steve Jobs were born in 55. I was born in 59. I was just a few years younger than they were, and look where they ended up, and look where I ended up in the computer industry.
Hey.
I mean,
so for me, you know, for me in 1983, I'm sitting in this studio that looks out over Los Angeles at the Anderson Books or Anderson Hardware Store in this big, huge loft. And there's a knock at the door, and there's a photographer and someone from Apple, you know, and they want to come in and they want to use the table and they want me to sit there in front of a Lisa computer that that Steve Jobs has invented. And by the next year, or with, I guess, in the next year, which is 84, what's his name? Ricky Saul Warman starts TED in Monterey.
Yeah.
And we're all there as designers and people of the industry of art and design, or TED, which is technology, education and design, right? And there's Steve Jobs in his suit with his thin tie, his white shirt, and these four little Macs at his waist, you know, sitting there on the table.
Yeah.
And you know, it was an amazing moment. You know, it was an incredible time.
That
even
was,
though, even though we had an older group of people looking at a younger evolution of this digital world to come, you know, to market.
I made it my place. I made it my journey to buy a Mac in 1984. I bought it. I also got the additional 10 megabyte hard drive for $3,400.
Yeah.
Wow.
And they had three or four different applications, you know. So I had I had one that was called something like something like DigiDraw or something like that. And Adobe wasn't there, and Aldus was just starting, and you know, it was the beginning of a very simplistic digital component, you know. And then within a year later, all of a sudden they had printers that they were selling through Apple, and then that became a whole new evolution, and look how that's grown.
John, I have to ask you, when you look at the Endless Summer poster, it's there's something about it. People have studied it. I mean, in art school, probably, I guess people have written PhD dissertations about it, because the three guys in the picture, I don't know how long you took to pose them, but the poses are unbelievably, you know, rich in detail and aspect to them. I mean, I guess Bruce Brown is in the foreground, and then these guys in the background, though, are posed in such a way that's very interesting and iconic. And then, but the colors, tell me about the colors. How did you decide on that? Was that just a thing to do? How did you do that?
Well, you know, part of being an art student is almost like a garage technology. You know, you find out in the outer world the most simple and the cheapest way to make something. And that was like a signage company that would silkscreen images on cardstock for people, like, you know, sale here and buy this and retail this product. So it, you know, the design went from a table at Art Center of putting a black, what they call a line resolution cell over these cut modernist Deglo colors, you know, to actually show what they called a comp to the client. And then from there, they would make film positives up and then silkscreen them onto paper in these Deglo colors. So that was all kind of new, bringing that into the world from this signage discipline that was going on in the normal industrial world, you know. So being so new like that, and being in this infant state of the actual culture, is that it really wasn't until 4 years later, when the film opened in New York, that a Martin Geisler of Personality Posters went to see Rugoff of Cinema 5, you know, and he said, "I'll make a one sheet of this." And so he went out to New Jersey, and he took the same colors and all the elements that were in the original poster, and took off all the writing that was basically confusing, and made a first run, what they called a one sheet for the theater there on on I guess that would be like First Street, First and 31st in New York, and that poster in front of the theater and the line around the block through the winter and the summer, that mm-hmm. poster became a national hit and an international hit. It went to PX's. You know, you can imagine the soldiers down in their tunnel at the end of the an area. There was like a temple with the Endless Summer poster and the and right. candles and all kinds of little fetish objects, you know, and the helicopters above.
Yep, yep.
And these guys wanting to go surf China. I guess it's called China Point or something like that in Vietnam. You know, it's the
right.
the stories I would hear, you know, from the people in colleges where they would say, "Oh yeah, I was the guy opened the door of his closet and there your fucking poster was," you know.
Oh my
well,
God!
Well, Joe, as I mentioned, you weren't on the tour for the unveiling. But all of these images are in this mural. There, I saw the helicopter. There's the waves. There's the surfer from the poster. In addition to, you know, an image of Jimi Hendrix and some other older musicians. Tell us about that because
Mozart, yeah, Mozart is there and Beethoven.
yeah,
Hendrix, yeah.
It's circular. What goes around comes around, you know. And
right. It's like a museum show. These are all these, you know, cultural images that I've been involved in over the last 50 years.
Right.
Yeah. It's like a tour of your life, your life's work in this. It's never ending, which goes back to
right. The right. And then there's 15 waves in different colors, you know, which is this mystical world that we live in. You know, the surf is always breaking around the world in all these different places. And we subliminally don't really kind of understand really the richness of that mystical world, that unknown world called the ocean. And so that becomes like, the waves become like a what would you call it, like a crown of points mm-hmm. that would stick up out right. of a, you know, out of the king's helmet there.
Yeah, it's amazing because I remember when I saw the helicopter, you have I remember seeing a black one. I don't know if you had them in other colors, but I remember focusing in on a black helicopter, and that sound that you just made went through
yeah.
my head. It went right through my head because I saw that image, and it just you hit it. Yeah.
Right, yeah. So on next Thursday, I'll be on that helicopter, you know, with a camera hanging out the door, taking pictures of the tank. That should be an amazing point of view. But really
the
other object there, which is so much a part of that aerospace industry, is the B-2 bomber. My father and I and my mother and sister came out from Maryland, Towson, Maryland, to work. He was working at Northrop at the beginning.
Oh.
Of the flying wing in 1950, you know, they were making wood and metal wings
mm-hmm.
And trying to put all metal wings together and make that plane fly, you know. So my father was literally in that industry probably for like 50 years or something like, no, about
wow.
35 years. And during
mm-hmm.
that time, he went from the flying wing to the B-1 bomber over those period of decades, you know, through the aviation, or, you know, the age of flight to the breaking of the sound barrier in outer space, huh? An amazing
wow.
evolution.
There's the movie that I'm thinking of is was released in May of 1979. Featured surfing. Most people don't remember that this movie.
My favorite movie.
Released in Apocalypse Now.
Yeah,
yep.
Apocalypse Now. You know, I love the smell of what is it?
Napalm. Napalm
in the morning. I love the smell of napalm.
Well, okay, and so morning. Lance Carson is hanging off the back of the boat, right? On water skis, right? And so my father basically worked with Mr. Carson at Northrop Aviation. And as I evolved as a surfer at 16, I met Lance Carson, the son of Mr. Carson. That's how weird it all is.
Yeah.
It's
a wonderful thing. John, you have had such an impact on the world of graphic arts. From your viewpoint, from your vantage point, how can someone today get started and really, you know, mark the world, change the world through a viewpoint? I mean, I think kids today must be scared to death in graphic arts. How can they create something new? You've done so many iconic pieces. You can't do it just like that, because then everyone will say, "Oh, that's a John Hammersveld."
Yeah, but it's done in different decades, you know, an evolution of industry. So in the beginning, it was publications, and then it was posters, and then it was records, and then it was signage for architecture, and then it was art and prints, and then it was murals. I mean, those are the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 decades. Each decade I changed into another, you know, a different person doing work for a different industry. And so someone starting doesn't have that perspective. So I'm looking back 60 years, being 16 at El Segundo High School and with a 2-hour art class with a great instructor, you know, who starts my life as an artist to where it is today. Right. You know, sitting there looking at the tank, standing there looking at the tank.
You'll be flying.
I'm not
you'll
in
be
a wheelchair.
You'll be flying over it looking at the tank. Joe, let's do a really quick station break so we can get right back to it.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the South Bay Show. We're having a wonderful discussion with John Van Hammersveld, American graphic artist. And we want you to experience one of his newest creations right on Grand Avenue in El Segundo. Just come up Grand Avenue from the beach or down through the heart of El Segundo towards the beach. You'll see it. It's amazing. Hopefully soon there will be lights and people will be able to see it at night. We're back. There's nothing else to say. Lots and lots of questions, Jackie.
Well,
lots of questions.
Oh, you're right. I have a whole list of questions, but I want to go back to the beginning, John. You grew up in PV. You mentioned your family moved from Maryland, but you grew up in PV and you're still in PV. Have you always been in Palos Verdes?
No. No, I left at 19 and went to art school downtown, and then ended up in the arts and entertainment business. You know, and at 19 I left as a surfer, and I was away for like 17 years just in town there, and then I moved to Malibu with some money and bought a house and a couple properties, and then I would surf for like probably 12 years, and. And then in coming back into Santa Monica for about 9 years, we decided that the traffic was so terrible and the town was so exploited. And it was like 2.5 hours from Santa Monica to downtown L.A. We looked on the map and trying to figure out, you know, how the freeways work and how we could go downtown. So we found this house in Palos Verdes. And so now we just take the Mercedes down to the Harbor Freeway into the fast track, and we're in town in 20 minutes. We get off at Adams and go into the city. So I have done a number of murals down there, and I'll probably do more.
Mm-hmm.
And, coming
the
back
murals.
To Palos Verdes is like 53 years later. You can imagine.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like Star Wars. Where were you? Where did you go? What a journey. Where have you been? You know, And so when I would do interviews, when I would do interviews with a Daily Breeze or, you know, or Easy Reader, you know, they would be gawking at me like, where have you been? What have you done? Oh, you did that. Oh, you've been there. Wow. Incredible. And so here you are now where you started. What a deal this is.
has Palos Verdes changed?
Well, you know, the urban design. So, you know, my grandfather was an inventor, and he used to be in Washington, D.C. He had spoken five languages going through all these prototypes and everything and at the Capitol and all that. So he understood what was going on all over the world. So he would take the train out here to work on the Palomar Observatory. And in that process, he would hear about this place called Palos Verdes, you know, and the Vanderlips had done such a beautiful job in putting it together in terms of architecture and the planting of all the trees, you know, almost like a park, you know. So my grandfather builds a house here in Lanada Bay, and we move out there, and we lived there for like 10 years. It was incredible. Just an amazing part of the world.
It is. So when you think of murals, do you think that these are powerful? I mean, they're powerful statements of public art, no doubt, and there are many different aspects to mural design and construction and so forth. Is that something that you love doing now, that kind of
art? Yeah, as an artist, you know, you have tools that you use and you have spaces that you fill up, you know, with your ideas. And most of that is in a kind of like a provincial Beaux-Arts sort of style of work, you know, with pencils and paint and drawings and brushes and all that. But that sort of went away in 1999, let's say, or 1995, I think, when that first computer really started working properly. Really, where we are today, although, you know, there's 23 years later or something like that, I'm painting with technology, and people really can't quite fathom that. Because when they say, oh, you're an artist, they immediately go to the fact that you're painting something. And so, so the painted mural is one thing, you know, but the technology of painting with technology is a whole other sort of advanced world that's plugged in to the printing of information. So let's say my grandfather at showing me these Primrose printed books in when I was like 13 or something like that. It was really about the printing press. So here we are today. It's still the printing press. It's just a digital press. And so when these sheets that were 10 by 32 feet going through a 14-inch printer, you know, it's the same thing. It's just it's about technology.
There's something, I think, new. There's something very powerful when governments and city officials and companies are artists today to cover their industrial, rusty, ugly things with your artwork. There's something consistent, and I think the people are saying to the city officials, wow, you guys are having good ideas again.
Yeah.
How is this is going on, and it's really exciting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Total
surprise, you know, Marty, Marty is this, the executive downtown, you know, who runs the DWP he's sold.
Yeah,
you want to do more?
Yeah,
it's renovation. Let's do it. Yeah.
He was very excited. He was very excited about this project. And will you be working with him again? It sounds like he really wants to work with you.
Oh
again.
Yeah, he spoke in those sort of terms. We've got to do more. You know, I have a couple locations.
Mm-hmm.
when Sam, who kind of was managing the project, he would come up to me and say, my boss downtown really knows who you are, and he really likes what you do. So it was, when I actually met him, it was like, wake up, John. Look at this enthusiasm. Look at the potential.
Right.
You know, when I was working on the Fatburger chain, at one part of my career here, I was like into signage and architecture, working with the SciArch school and being a teacher there and trying to teach architects about how to put a sign on a building. I ended up with this Fatburger chain to design, and it's the same thing, is I would put these colorful buildings in these neighborhoods and everybody would get really excited. Like, wow, this is new. And then the chains were looking at it as well. So it was like a whole kind of the same kind of thing as it was bringing art to the street, to the public in a different form. A hamburger stand, the last great hamburger stand, Fatburger.
Thanks.
So that trademark today, is seen around the world, and they have those restaurants and, have them in Dubai and they have them in China. So you can't imagine that sort of Western Avenue, little tiny building, and these two women creating a culture in the 50s around this Fatburger object. And that becoming a worldwide chain is pretty amazing. And the trademark being very much like the Endless Summer, everybody knows it.
Well, speaking of trademarks, speaking of trademarks, I've seen your Endless Summer poster used in other capacities. It's like you franchised it almost. Can you
there's a licensing agent. Yeah, there's a licensing agent, which is a part of Bruce Brown Films. Bruce passed away in December, but his licensing company will continue to feed or work with those 150 licensees. So, and I'm only the designer of the singular object. They have other, there's all kinds of companies working for them, and they're making making their millions. But it's the same thing with Fatburger. You're paid like $200,000 to design the architecture and the logo, and then this is like 27 years later. Look what happened.
Right.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
I'm looking at the Fatburger's website. They have some new stores. There's one in Washington, one in Santa Monica, Fontana, and Tokyo.
Yeah, how about that? And Dubai.
There's one right. There's one right down the street from my house.
Yeah.
I'll never look at it
yes,
the same
there
way
is.
Again. Never look at
That's
it the
my
same
favorite.
Way again.
Yeah.
A John
so, Hammersfeld you know, that,
loco.
Yeah. Who would ever know, right? Bruce Brown and I were sitting at a table in Hermosa at the auditorium there probably about 2 years ago signing Endless Summer posters, and he has his pencil in hand and everything, and he's looking over at me as I'm starting to sign another poster, and he says, "Who would ever know?"
Mm-hmm. Who could have guessed?
Yeah. Well, now,
unbelievable.
Now, tell us about the future. Tell us about, are there any scoops that you can give us, John, about things you're doing? Because some
of
the things
future,
you're doing now.
The future is really about, kind of a system that I've kind of created for myself, is that I draw all my images, so that is called, analog. And then I take a photograph of it, and then I digitally, in a sense, move that over into a computer. And then in the computer, I'm able to what they call vectorize it, which is take all the continuous tone away and make a very lightweight outline that I can put a color inside that shape. And then I layer those shapes into compositions, and then I'm able to make these mural kind of objects that are, you know, sometimes 12 inches high by, you know, 50 inches long, you know, and then I send that to a to my manufacturer, and then they put it in their computer, tune it all up, and then they print that out, you know. So mm-hmm. so this mm-hmm. painting and technology, working in analog, digital, and output, the output is really called simulation. So you're always simulating something that, that could be analog. And we're living in that kind of world now where, you know, the car is being taken over by the computer. It's becoming a computer, an autonomous driver, which is really
no
a simulation of what we, you know, what we have known for the last 100 years, you know, is stepping into a car. Right. It's an analog experience. You know, all of a sudden now you're just sitting in the car, and the car's driving you somewhere that you said to the computer, take me there.
I mean, Jackie had a recent
experience.
That's
where we are today, yeah. So everything is becoming automated and simulated.
Where she bought a printer, got it set up. What happened, Jackie?
Bought a new printer, set it up as several weeks ago. And I received an email from Best Buy saying that my printer ordered cartridges because it was low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See,
how do you like that?
Within the simulation, everything is auditable. You know, it's all being edited and audited. Yeah.
It freaked me out a little bit. I mean, I know that there are refrigerators that will tell you when you're low on milk or you need more butter. But I was a little surprised to actually have my printer order cartridges without me having to do anything. So, yeah, but that's where we are. You're right. You're right. Well,
you go back to 2000. You know, you go back to 2000 when this all started, that they wanted to do credit cards, you know, on the internet. And everyone said, oh, gosh, that's an open medium. How could you do that? How would the bank get involved in something like that? So essentially I went to a kind of like a polling company seminar. And there were like 18 people who worked on polls. And they said to me, they said, listen, you know, you have your laptop there. And, you know, that is a transparent world. There is not a wall. There's a firewall there, but you can go out and someone can come in. And that was the beginning of this auditing by everyone around the world. So as soon as you came onto the net, they were there inside your computer looking at all kinds of different things that you were doing and modeling you. And that's where we are today, is that it's a transparent world, and we have all these machines that have been provided to deal with the digital world. Again, the simulation of analog.
John, when were you born?
1941. John Hopkins. John Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore.
Why do you think, I mean, it isn't just the graphic arts. It's your attitude. It's your personality that comes through your artwork. You are constantly evolving. You seem excited about the future. The next thing is the most exciting thing to you. Where does that come from, John?
Probably my grandfather. He was a Dutch kid that went to art and science school in Amsterdam, you know, took the train in from Harlem. And got on the Rotterdam boat when he was like 23 or something like that with his sister, and came to Pennsylvania and went to work for Westinghouse. And he admired Westinghouse because he had so many patents. And so what my grandfather wanted to be is a patent inventor. So he, through the Warren & Swayze Company, every Monday he would be in Washington, D.C. for the week, staying at the Mayfair Hotel, and they would interview in five different languages all these designers from around the world who had prototypes for this, you know, for the industrial world that he was working in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So he would take the gentleman in German, you know, his prototype. He would take them across the street to the patent office, and they would take out a patent application. They would get on the train, go back to Cleveland over the weekend, and he would have a whole culture there of things to do and restaurants and music events. And then the gentleman would go back to Washington, back to his country. I mean, that's that's my grandfather. So he taught these two boys how to make things, and they became entranced with the the world of the age of flight, right? And they took off as designers and engineers of planes. And my father was so brilliant at 13. He was like making his way through school, high school and college, making models for all these people of little airplanes. So the family just had this kind of imagination, this engineering, you know. And my mother was an artist then, so she made images, but the two of them, you know, would sit there on the table and have discussions, and they would always have a little piece of paper, and they would draw out what they were thinking about. So that's mm-hmm. what I experienced mm-hmm. as a kid. So when I went to school, right. it was like opening up a whole new world to me. And then I would join these industries, and they're changing per decade. I would just go with it. I couldn't stop because my industry was changing and I had to change with it. So every decade right. was a different decade. Every decade was a different technology, a different view of itself, a reflection of itself.
Yeah.
So art is really about a reflection of something that's going on in culture. And so the artist imagines and then imprints that on some object or, you know, on a flat plane or a sculpture or whatever. And then the culture looks at that image and sees something in it that it's intrinsic to that decade. So like the album covers, you know, you could smell them, you could buy them, you know, you could listen to them, you could, you know, wash them in the sink after the party, you know, I mean, it was a time, you know, it was a time as it was like in the 90s with a hamburger, you know, as it has been in the 2000s here with the Endless Summer's 50th anniversary, looking back upon this culture that has been developed over the last 50 years. Pretty amazing.
So I need some inspiration. What's going on today in the world that you see and you say, I don't have time, but wow, that really, someone needs to focus on that and draw images out of that and reflect that.
Okay, you want to hear it, huh? You want to hear what the future's about? So, I meet people all the time, constantly, and I have interactions with them. And so my son decided that he was going to take me over to this VRLA event downtown last weekend. So, mm-hmm. and he's telling me, this is a new industry, Dad, you know, as if I was, 20 years ago taking him to see computers mm-hmm. and telling him that this was a new world that you could grow up mm-hmm. in. So he is a computer interactive person, you know, in the industry, you know. So this is a new kind of thing. So we're walking around this place, or the convention center, looking at all these particular booths, and all of a sudden we stop at one, and my son starts up a conversation with this company that makes VRs to look at cars. So you put this mm-hmm. Helmet on, you know, and you look, and you're able to see the inside and the outside of the car three-dimensionally, right? So all of a sudden, mm-hmm. there's a person standing next to me with a little beard, and he says, John, how are you? Hey, what's happening? So it turns out to be the father of the son who's running the whole thing, and their company is called VRLA. Now, okay. I met David at my studio in San Pedro when we had it for a couple of years, and he said, I'm going to buy all this stuff from you, but I'm entranced with it. I want to make a VR of your studio. So they bring the camera over, and they set it up in three different places, and they make up this VR, and they gave me a pair of glasses, and I was showing them to people and everything, and this was the new age, you know. So here we are like 2 or 3 years later, and they've made an enormous sum of money, and they've become a whole industry. And there I am, they're tapping me on the shoulder and saying, so would you do something for us? You know, like wrap a car or something like that. So it all goes forward, you know, I mean, it doesn't go backwards.
JVH virtual reality experience.
Yeah, it's about to come that way. I was thinking like, I'm working in murals, so I should do something three-dimensional. How do I work that, you know? And so what VR is what we've been involved in for the last, 30 years is this this object for the fourth dimension, you know, not having any vanishing point. It just floats there as an object. And so here we are with this very sophisticated digital world, and now we can say, okay, now we can put that in a program, and we can put that on someone's face, and they can see a whole nother world in four dimensions.
Right.
No vanishing points.
Wow.
No vanishing points.
Yes.
So they're going to be inside the world.
Inside the world. Yes, that's what they're trying to promote. You know, so there was one booth. This is a great example. You know, is that it had like a poker table. You know, and it had the hands laying on the table, and then the chairs were set back probably about 4 feet or something like that. And there's a person sitting in there, and they have the helmet on, and and they're moving their hands around, you know, having no contact whatsoever, but thinking that they are within their image. They're playing cards. They're putting cards on the table, and they're putting money on their in the exchange. That's the way it is. There's no reality to it. It's all a self-designed fantasy that's put into VR, and that's the that fantasy is you're able to. Do something that's in another reality, the fourth dimension.
It sounds like an episode of Westworld.
Very much so. Totally.
Very much.
Totally.
Yeah.
And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the simulated world.
Right.
That's
right.
What Westworld
Steven Spielberg's
is all
new movie, Ready Player One.
I haven't been to see that
Ready
yet.
Player One.
Yeah.
All about VR.
You know, This hour flew by. We got to wrap it up in a minute. But here's the thing: I wanted to hear all of these stories of yours from back in the day about the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix and stuff. And here we are talking about virtual reality. You're not resting on your laurels, John.
Well, you know, I went from art school to Capitol Records to the Beatles and all that, and then started a company called Pinnacle Productions. And in the first 4 or 5 shows, I end up standing in front of Jimi Hendrix personally, right? And I'm asking him, what do you think of L.A.? And he says, it's confusing.
It can be.
Yeah.
It can be.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Joe, we got to wrap it up.
John Van Hammersveld, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It's quite an opportunity to get on your airwaves. Yeah.
And, well, you know, the beautiful thing about this, John, is this conversation. The people that want to have a conversation with you can feel like they've had a conversation with you by listening to this show. And, of course, this show is international. It can go anywhere on the planet. Anyone with internet access can listen
to
this show. That's, yeah. It's amazing. We get listeners from all over, but we're excited to have had you on. Thank you for joining us today. We love you and all, everything you do. JVH.cool. JVH.cool. And then you can get access to everything post-future.com. And, of course, thank you, Jackie.
Always a pleasure, Joe. And everybody, make sure to drive up Grand Avenue and see this fabulous new mural in our South Bay.
Thank you so much for the call.
I think what you've done, John, is you've marked your historical association with El Segundo in such a beautiful, amazing way. I'm sure the community is thrilled. I'm sure the community is very thankful for it. We're all thankful for it. That's our show, ladies and gentlemen. Enjoy public art. Get out there and create and have a fantastic experience. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you.